So I've been asked to talk on the true individual, which of course is, I teach, I'm from Bantu, and I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. And also I wanted to say that part of the inspiration for what I'm going to say tonight has also come from a talk, actually on discipleship. It was a talk given, I think in, some of you might remember, who've been ordained for a while, in either 1995 or 1997 on an order convention. It was just after I was ordained. It was by an order member called Ratna Guna, and it was called Discipleship in the Western Buddhist Order. And I always remember, the way I always describe this talk to myself when I think of it, I always think, oh, it was the talk that made grown men cry, because I remember people being very, very affected by it and quite stirred by it and quite, you know, it was quite a challenging talk, so it made people really reflect. And it's in a little booklet, actually. I really recommend it. You can get it from Parmaloka Books. So I've drawn some of the inspiration for what I want to say from that as well. So this teaching of the true individual, well, I think you've already had Parmi talking about the group and the spiritual community already. So this sort of set of teachings, the group, the true individual, and the spiritual community, is really like what Bantu's given us. It's kind of a sort of original, brilliant even, teaching from Bantu. Like you won't find those terms. You go back to the Pali Canon, you won't find the terms, the group, or the, you know, and the true individual. At the same time, it's completely in the spirit of the Dharma, you know, the true individual, which I'll say more about, but you could, if you were to kind of gloss it, you might gloss it as someone who was capable of, well, standing alone, being alone. And if you go right back, of course, to the life story of the Buddha, that's like a theme in the Buddha's journey to enlightenment, isn't it? Even a sort of motif in that journey. You know, you've got the Buddha leaving the palace, and then like Vinchanda leaves him behind, he's on his own, terrified actually in the forest before he's enlightened, but doesn't like fear defeat him. You've got him, you know, then meeting the two teachers, but then once again, when he doesn't take up their offer of leadership of their groups, he's once again alone in the forest. He meets the five ascetics. When they leave him in disgust because he's taken the milk rice, he's once again alone. And when he sits under what becomes the Bodhi tree, he's alone. So although this is this term, the true individual, is one coined by Bantu. And sort of, yeah, an original contribution by Bantu. It goes right, you can find the principle right back in the life story of the Buddha. So I'm imagining that most of you are probably familiar with this term. So I'll just say a little bit about it, and then I'll try and expand it then. So when Bantu talks about the true individual, he's talking about somebody who's sort of treading the middle way between conforming to the, I was going to say values, actually, it's pressures really, it's not values, it's pressures of like the tribe, conforming to the pressures and the influence of the tribe on one hand. So it's the middle way between that on the one hand and what Bantu is called the individualist, kind of the rebel really, the kind of going against the grain just simply for the sake of it on the other hand. So you've got those two extremes, and we probably, you know, all fall into the one or the other or ricochet between both to a greater or lesser degree. And then you've got the true individual who's, you know, not simply halfway between those extremes, but over and above those two extremes. So that's how Bantu's defined the true individual. A true individual, somebody, another way you could maybe gloss it is say somebody who doesn't need the approval of the group. actually, who doesn't need their disapproval either. Some people thrive on the disapproval, don't they, as much as the approval. So a true individual neither needs the approval of the group, doesn't need the approval of anyone, and doesn't kind of sort of just ricochet the other way and sort of thrive on the disapproval, isn't a sort of, you know, rebel without a cause, isn't just a rebel for the sake of it. And it's become a very, very familiar teaching in Tri Ratna, this teaching of the true individual. This sort of concept of individuality is become for us a kind of yardstick of our own progress. It's how we, it's one way we can look at ourselves. We can ask ourselves, well, is this or that the act of an individual or not? We can notice, we can sort of assess ourselves like that. We can, you know, that's one way we can look at our own practice. And as I say, sometimes we might, you know, we might act in a way that is truly individual. I would imagine for most of us, most of the time, we're falling into sort of sliding, maybe falling's too drastic, sliding over to one or other of these sort of tendencies. So you've got the extreme poles, but also they're like tendencies, the tendency to conformity or the tendency to individualism. Yeah, I was remembering way back, I used to work in a Buddhist cafe we used to have called the Cherry Orchard. Some of you might have heard it. Of it, and I remember I worked there for a long time, so I saw quite a lot of new team members come and go, and it was quite interesting. I know when people when we're new to a situation, that's also when we sort of revert to type, isn't it? That's often when we everyone's a bit new, so we kind of we fall back on our habitual tendencies. Can also be a chance, I guess, to go beyond them, but more often than not, we fall back on them. I'd really noticed that with people coming to work in the Cherry, as it was then. People did seem to go one of these other ways, so I was always astonished that you got, like, perfectly capable women. It was a women's team, you know, who maybe, I don't know, brought up a family, held down a very responsible job. How they'd come into the team and be so kind of concerned in case they did the wrong thing. You know, I always called it like, what knife shall I use to cut this cake syndrome? You know, people that were kind of, you know, you kind of thought, I know you know that, but, you know, they were very fearful of doing the wrong thing. Then you got other people, like day one, you know, they'd be totally telling you how to run the place, you know, they'd haven't even been there, you know. So again, that's the kind of, and we probably recognise ourselves in one or other of those tendencies. And as I say, we often kind of ricochet from one to the other. So what we're trying to do is we're all the time, one way of looking at our Dharma practice is that we're trying to sort of transcend, to use that word, those extremes, those tendencies. We're trying to become someone who doesn't need the approval, but also someone who isn't just trying to be different just for the sake of it. So that's a kind of in a little nutshell, that teaching of the true individual. But what I want to particularly talk about tonight, well, is the fact that being a true individual isn't an end in itself. The true individual is always in relation to others. It's in our Dharma lives, the true individual is always in relation to Sangha. Actually, in the dinner upstairs that we just had, when I said to everybody that's what the talk was on, and Eva, you said that's the greatest paradox, the true individual and the Sangha. How can you be both a true individual and be part of a Sangha? So that's what I want to explore tonight. And I want to explore it under three headings. So what I want to sort of argue, and you can argue back if you want later on, I think, but is that I want to argue in three ways. I want to say that if you want to be a friend, a real friend, you have to be a true individual. And I want to argue that if you want to help people, if you want to alleviate suffering in the world, you have to be a true individual. And I want to argue that if you want to be a disciple, you have to be a true individual. And I also give you an argument for why you might want to be a disciple as well. So this should be fun. I hope you do argue back. So let's start with being a true individual and friendship. I'm just going to say a few things. It isn't by any means exhaustive. It's just almost, things that immediately popped into my head when I was thinking about this. So you might have more of your own thoughts. So what I'm saying is that the more of a true individual you are, the more of a friend you can be. To the extent you're a true individual, to that extent you can really be a friend. And I think the sort of baseline, the sort of principle here is that to the extent you're a true individual, you aren't thinking, what's in it for me? So somebody who's not a true individual, somebody who needs that approval, is going to, somewhere is always going to be thinking, what's in it for me? Now that might be quite, might be quite gross, but it might be quite subtle as well. Like that what's in it for me? You want something back. To the extent you're not a true individual, you want something back. So you aren't able to be generous, completely generous with yourself, because you're always kind of thinking, oh, what am I going to get out of this for myself? And so I think without generosity, without just that simple sharing of ourselves, we're not really going to be a friend. Or put the other way around, to the extent we can share ourselves without wanting return, as it were, to that extent we can be a friend. I was thinking as well, a true individual is somebody who can... Was that something about the friendship extending over time? Someone who can... Well, be loyal, I guess. I was thinking back to, when you were a child on the playground, loyalties were very fickle, weren't they, as a child on the playground? Like, you'd be best friends with somebody one minute, and then, the next minute, you're totally with another gang or another friend. And that's because, as a child, we weren't integrated, we weren't sort of adult. So it takes our... It takes integration, it takes being grown up to a certain extent to really, to be a friend, to be able to bring loyalty and fidelity to friendship. And again, we can only do that to the extent we're individual, because it's only to the extent we, can hold to our own values. We aren't being, continually swayed by... what people are going to think of us, who's going to approve of us, who's going to disapprove of us. When we're to the extent we're swayed by that, we can't be sort of true to ourselves and true to our own values. And to that extent, there's nothing that can continue over time. It's a very unintegrated state to be, because... Yeah, it's just was disintegrated over time, and therefore we can't. It makes it impossible to be loyal. It makes it impossible to be faithful to friendship. Yes, it's. What else was I thinking about this? I was thinking another thing that I think real friendship is. There's got to be in real friendship is apology and forgiveness. And again, to the extent that we're not an individual, we can't really apologise. Very, very interesting. One of my favourite parts of Bhante's teaching on ethics, he talks about it in Transforming Self and World, I think. is that he's talking about confession, but you might as well, you might as well substitute apology for that. And in some ways, actually, I think apology can be even stronger than confession in a way, because it's in direct relation to the person you've hurt or offended. But anyway, he says, he's talking about how to confess, and one of the points he makes is, you can't confess if guilt is present. And then when he explores guilt, he says the guilt is based on a need for approval. Like, we will feel like guilt is an emotion of, I'm going to be blamed, somebody's going to withdraw their love from me. It's totally dependent, it's totally bound up, I should say, with whether we've been approved of or not. We're not free when we're caught up with guilt. We're not free. If we apologise out of guilt, it's not actually a real apology. It's just wanting the person to like us again, you know, or it's wanting to assuage the guilt. Only when we've freed ourselves from guilt can we fully confess and apologise. Of course, you don't want to, I always want to caveat all these things. You don't want to wait until you're completely a true individual to confess and apologize. You know, one where we purified in the doing of it as well. But it's good to remember that, it's horrible actually to be in guilt, isn't it? But if we unpick that, we'll see that at base it's because we fear that someone's going to withdraw their love, either a real person or a sort of internalised judge figure or something. And again, because we're dependent on that approval, we're not acting as an individual. So that's what I'm meaning when I'm saying that in order to be able to apologise, the more individual that we are, the more we can apologise. And more I've come to think that, you know, the ability to apologise and forgive, which is, you know, the same thing really, the other way around. Again, if we're not an individual, we're not going to be able to forgive, but somehow, I don't know, we're too caught up with the other person in a way. We're too kind of, if we're not forgiving somebody, it's often because we think, what do we do? It's like we think, oh, if I forgive them, I'll be sort of letting them off the hook or something, without realising that that's actually nothing to do with it. Whether they're on the hook or off the hook is nothing to do with our ability to forgive. Our ability to forgive is our inner process. It will affect that other person. In a certain sense, it's not got to do with them. In a certain sense, it is relational. Without forgiveness and apology, we won't have friendship. And without individuality or a move towards more true individuality rather than need for approval, we won't be able to apologise and forgive. I was thinking about this, and then suddenly another penny dropped for me. And I thought, okay, I'm thinking about this, you have to be a true individual to be a true friend, or to the extent that you are a true individual, you can be a true friend. But I thought, talking about it like that, it makes it all sound a bit sort of static or something. Like there's person A, and I'm person B, and I'm trying to be a friend to them, and hopefully I can be a good one, and that'll all be good. Da, da, da. But actually, it's not like that in real life, is it? It's much, much more, you spark each other off. So it's not that you just bring my kind of, you know, improved person B-ness to person A, and that's quite nice for them. It's actually, the more of an individual I am or they are, the more the whole relationship sort of lifts up, doesn't it? That's what's so great actually about it. Well, particularly going back to apology and forgiveness, it can be so hard to do, can't it? I mean, I kind of hate that moment just before an apology. You're thinking, I'm not going to do it. And you kind of go, come on, Supervisor Matty, just do it. And then you do, and actually it often transforms the whole relationship. It's not just the same relationship with a sort of apology thrown in, like, I don't know, you might throw an ingredient, some currants into the cake mix or something. It actually transforms the whole thing, often. Not just with apology, any creative act will transform the whole thing. So that's just that. There's a few thoughts on true individuality and friendship. So I just want to say a little bit more before I move on to the next of my three. So I'm saying that you have to be a true individual to be a friend. But also, being a friend helps you to be a true individual. So it works both ways. So by trying to enact these things, by trying to be the best friend you can, by trying to apologise as a practice, even if you don't feel like it, forgive someone as a practice, even if you don't, in a sense, feel like it, you can still take it on as a practice. Even if you practice generosity, then... in relation to another person, because you care about them, you will move towards being more of a true individual. So it's working from both ends, actually. So one helps the other. The other thing that's helped me, I was just thinking about this because people were asking me in this little dinner that was mentioned, people were asking me about my own life and practice and history. I live in a community. I've lived for many years in a community, 12 of us all women living together. And I did, I thought, all my life I've spent like a lot of time in single sex situations, and I think that's really helped. It's kind of a bit hard for me to tell because it's been my whole life in a way. Who knows what would have happened to me without that. It's been from my early 20s to my now early 50s, living and working in many single-sex situations. I think that has really helped me in the path of individuality. It's helped me to... unpick and unlearn maybe even the little reliances that I might have unconsciously had on, well, men in my case, you know, and I've seen it the other way around with men to women. So when I was thinking of what helps in this practice of trying to be a true individual in relation to friendship, I think my time in single sex situations has really helped in that. It's helped me then when I, you know, I'm now on the College of Public Preceptors, just joined, which is, you know, the college is a mixed men and women situation. The London Buddhist Centre where I work and teach, that's mixed men and women. I think it has helped in being more conscious and more of an individual in relation, well, particularly to the men I work with, women too, but particularly I think the single sex situations have helped with that. So anyway, there might be some questions on that later if there's time. So I wanted to move on to my next little assertion, argument, the thing I'm arguing, which is about helping people and wanting to be a benefit in the world. So again, I think you can only really help. You can only really help to alleviate suffering in the world to the extent you're a true individual. Again, I think otherwise one falls back on. You end up in the what's in it for me. We might find ourselves helping people. But there's a little sneaky bit of ourselves, well, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I imagine it's not, that's kind of going, I hope somebody notices, like, you know, either they themselves notice or just somebody notices. And to that extent, it's probably still better helping them than not helping, but to that extent, it's like there's too much me in it to be really helpful. And as long as there's too much me in it, well, I'm going to get into trouble because I am, you know, still afflicted by greed, hatred and delusion. So, you know, one's bringing that into it. The example that always comes to mind when I think of this, I think of a time when I was a good few years ago, I was helping my sister who was very ill with cancer at the time. She's recovered now. I spent a couple of years, you know, a good part of a couple of years helping her look after her children and helping her. I felt like at the time I felt like I was quite freely doing this. I felt like happy to do it, glad to be free. And she's made a recovery, and there was a sort of landmark. I think maybe it was five after she'd been clear for 5 years, or maybe it's her birthday. Anyway, there was some occasion. There was a celebration in her family, and she made a little kind of informal speech, and she said. She started saying yes. She said, "It's, you know, I'm so glad I've recovered." And she said, "And you know, but and out of everything, you know, that's helped me recover," she says, "there's one thing. There's one thing that's really helped the most." And as she said that, I could feel myself kind of preening. You know, I was kind of thinking, "Okay, this is my moment." You know, and so I was kind of slightly. She said, "Yeah." She said, "Drinking lots of water." You know that moment you hope nobody noticed, you know? and that was quite interesting because it showed me, well, yeah, there was still that, you know, I want to notice. Yes, I have done it, but I wanted, there was still that bit of me. Well, too much me, I'm saying, too much me. It wasn't as freely given as I would have liked to think. Often that's when we know, isn't it? That's often the test, isn't it, when something like that happens, you know, or when we lose something or something, that's when we know where our attachments lie. So on one hand, again, I think that's one extreme. We can get a bit, one very extreme would be to get very inflated by what a good person we were, helping everyone. Bante somewhere calls it compulsive altruism, and that's one extreme. And again, we imagine we're not at the extreme most of the time, but it's just interesting to notice if we've leaned into that. We want to be noticed. We want to be thanked. We want something. Yeah, we want some recognition. But I think the answer isn't to sort of go to the other extreme and sort of acting as if you haven't got any influence at all. I was thinking of this. I was thinking of this particularly coming here, and I imagine Rat Nagosha would be here because he taught me a few lessons in this regard. I remember, like many, many years ago, before I was ordained, I was still a mitra, and I was doing a little bit of meditation teaching at a local university, little class we had for students there, a couple of us mitras, and I was teaching the class for, I don't know, a year or something like that, and then for some reason I was stopping teaching, and I can't remember why I was stopping, maybe I was going off to get ordained or something. Anyway, I wasn't coming back, I was stopping for good, I wasn't coming back, and there weren't that many people, maybe four or five people had been coming to this class, and I remember walking in, it was such a lesson to me, this. I walked into the class and I said, at the end of class, I said, "Oh, thanks, everybody." I said, "Oh, by the way, that's me finished now. I'm not coming back anymore. Bye then." And I just noticed one man, his face just, like it just really fell, you know. And suddenly I thought, I saw the verse, I thought, oh God, like, I'm his meditation teacher. You know, imagine most of you, I certainly do remember who your first meditation teacher was. Like, I've got very, very clear memory. But I suddenly thought, I'm his meditation teacher. And I've just like casually said, I've been too casual. That's what I mean by going to the other extreme. So one extreme is getting inflated and intoxicated, but the other's kind of, I don't know, it's a sort of weird thing we can do is sort of pretend we're not having any effect at all. It's a sort of misguided, it's trying not to do that thing, but it's misguided. And why I remember Ratna Ghosha in this respect, he was the chair of the London Buddhist Centre at the time, and I was chatting to him and I said, oh God, I just did this thing, I feel really bad about it. And he said, ah, yes, he said, that's why. He said something like, that's why we usually have order members teaching. He said, because it's not just about the teaching, you know, it's about being able to have the maturity to realise the effect that you have. I always remembered that as a little lesson, well, quite a big lesson, actually, that there's a maturity in knowing the effect you have on other people. And knowing that you might have helped them and sort of honouring that. And the sort of on from that, in terms of what's helped me in this this sort of sphere of trying to practice being a true individual is, well, we call it the path of responsibility. That always sounds so kind of prosaic, doesn't it, and a bit clunky, but I can't think of a better way of putting it. But that what we call in Sri Ratna the path of responsibility, whether that's like teaching a class or I'm a Mitra convener at the Buddhist Centre, or you know, being responsible in relation to someone else in any way, it might be formal or it might be informal, I find that's really helped. So it's not that we're responsible for people, but we're responsible in relation to people. So, you know, and as I say, it might be a formal responsibility, but it might be informal. You know, it might be if you're on a class team, just remembering, oh, I might be the first Buddhist that someone meets. So you're responsible in relation to that. And I find that's really, really helped me. And you know, that teaching that Ratna Ghosha gave me it's helped me to realise that I do have an effect in the world. Now, the thing is, we all have an effect on the world all the time. I mean, that's the law of karma, the law of Pratityasamutpada. But it can be difficult to remember that because, well, I don't know what it's like for you, but inside you're kind of going, oh, but it's only me. You know, it's only me. Like, I'm not really... How can, like, little me be actually having an effect on the world? But actually, we are having an effect. And we have to realise that in all spheres. But, you know, particularly in the ethical sphere, of course. It's like knowing... I think what I'm calling the path of responsibility has helped me to see that effect more clearly and... It kind of gives you something to live up to. It's quite hard to talk about that because it can so easily sound like you're just acting a part or something, but it's not that. It's that you're actually, maybe that's the best way to put it, you're trying to live up to what, well, even this isn't right, I was going to say you're trying to live up to what people are investing in you. Every way you try and say it, it makes it sound a bit like something you're sort of self-consciously doing, but hopefully I'm conveying the spirit of it, that if people are relating to you as, for example, the first Buddhist they've met or somebody who's teaching them or, you know, somebody like myself as the Mitra convener, that it calls something forth. And I think you could say what it calls forth is trying to become more of an individual, and that means taking responsibility for the effect one has in the world. Hope that's clear. You can ask me again. You can ask me about it. Okay. So this is my third topic now. That that to be to the extent that one is a true individual, to that extent one can be a disciple, to that extent one can feel devotion, to that extent one can feel gratitude. So this is, I'm going to maybe spend a little bit longer on this. So in a way, I've talked about being a true individual in relation to friends. I've talked about being a true individual in relation to, you know, people who are suffering, people we want to help. And now I'm talking about it in relation to people that are, for want of a better way of putting it, further along the path than ourselves. How are we going to be a true individual in relation to them? So what a non-individual will do, if we're not an individual in relation to someone who's further along the path, more developed, more insightful, more wise, more compassionate, well, one extreme of what a non-individual will do is, well, simply won't believe that actually there is anybody further along the path. Yeah? So that's one extreme. That's like, it's like that kind of pseudo-egalitarianism that we often talk about, thinking like, you know, well, actually no one's better than anyone else. So that's one extreme. Possibly that kind of arrogance as well. The other extreme, of course, is gullibility. You see, this is quite an interesting one because, yeah, the one that would be the other pole would just to be very kind of unthinkingly, I don't know, looking up to someone, but not in a very wise way. I think that's probably, again, you can argue with this if you care to afterwards. I think in today's world that is probably less likely. I think we are wary of that. We sort of fear that. We don't want to be that person who's gullible. But I think that makes a swing to the other extreme. Like, you know, it's interesting, my work as Mitra convener, you know, so I'm often meeting people quite new to the centre and people who are even thinking of becoming a Mitra, but nearly almost what they say to me is, I don't want to join a group. You know, we don't want to be that gullible person that's going to be swept up, for good reason, because that's like, you know, we know what happens if you do that. So they're the two extremes. So this is quite an interesting one to navigate. So one way of thinking of it, one way I think of it, is that to the extent that we are a true individual, to that extent we can allow ourselves to be given a new perspective by someone who's further along the path, more wise, more insightful. So do you see what I'm saying this quite carefully here, because it's like, we're in relation to that person, but also we're in relation to ourselves. So we're allowing them to give us a new perspective. So I've got an example of that to illustrate it. So a few years ago, I wrote this book called Not About Being Good on Ethics. And before I wrote the book, I wrote to Bhante, telling him I was writing the book and asking for his blessing, which he gave me, and that was very heartening to have that blessing from Bhante. And then I wrote the book, and then it was published by Windhorse Publications, which was great. And what they wanted me to do, Windhorse, was they said, okay, so what we'd really like you to do is like go on a tour around all the Tree Ratna centres, certainly the ones in the UK, maybe one, and like promote the book, and that would be really good because, you know, help us sell the book. And I thought, I'm not doing that. Like, that's like a rubbish idea. I'm going to like go all the way to Glasgow to sell like 5 books. You know, I might as well save the train fare. And, you know, it didn't seem very economical. I thought, I'd be better staying in the London Buddhist Centre, which is quite big. I could do like loads of courses and stuff. And like, if what we want to do is sell more books, I'd be better just staying where I am rather than going off and spend all this money on train fares and, you know, selling a few books here and there. So I thought, oh yeah, like, sort of scrap that idea, you know. I sort of kept that to myself anyway. But that was what I was thinking. And then, but then I wrote a Bante, you see, and I said, oh, Bante, I've written the book is done. And he wrote back, now one thing was he wrote back very, very quick. Then it was only a few years ago, so already he was elderly and also quite, you know, not really in great health then. But I was amazed to get a reply within less than 24 hours, very kind of Bante-like, you know, dear Sir Bhadramati, I'm very glad that your 10 lectures on ethics have been turned into a book, not about being good, a practical guide to Buddhism. Then he said, I hope the book will be properly launched with a tour of centres and a talk at each centre. So I thought, well, that's what we told. But what was interesting was somehow Bante saying this, well, it suddenly changed, basically when I did that thing that I've just tried to describe, it changed my perspective. I suddenly thought, oh, okay, so I wonder why Bante, everything is conscious, I wonder why Bante thought that. I just kind of thought something like, okay, if you're Bante, how do you think of things? You probably don't think in terms of train fares and da-da-da. Like, he's probably thinking, obviously I don't know, this was a sort of thing, he's probably thinking, well, ethics, that's quite an important subject. A book on ethics is a good thing. Perhaps, I don't know this, it's a guess, perhaps a Dharmacharani writing a book on ethics. At that time there hadn't been that many Dharmacharanis writing Dharma books, so perhaps it was even that I was a Dharmacharani. But anyway, it's a good thing to have talks on ethics at centres. It's nothing to do with train fares and profit margins and stuff in that way. It's actually good to have talks at ethics, maybe by a Dharmacharani, I don't know, that's a guess I'm hazarding. And I thought, oh yeah, so then I could do it. I said, this is quite important, so then I could do it. So in a sense, I wasn't doing it because Bante told me. But in another sense, I was, because... So in one sense, I wasn't, because it was like I was now doing it with my own free will. But in another sense, it was, because it was like Bante telling me, like... You know, if another friend had told me, I'd have probably gone, no, like, don't understand train fares, da-da-da, calculations, you know. But because it was Bante, and because I listened to Bante, you know. So that's, you know, actually I'm not claiming to be a true individual, like, by saying this, but I'm just trying to say, well, maybe in that moment I did feel a little bit about what being a true individual in relation to someone that you look up to, or more than look up to, or devoted to, you know, who's beloved by you, you know, in relation to that. So I think that was me getting a bit of a glimpse of that. So it was my devotion to Bante that made me listen, that actually made me even think, what does Bante mean? So again, this is a bit of a tricky area, isn't it? The area of devotion, because... So I'm saying, like, a true individual will feel devotion, but as we know, like, just like metta, just like gratitude, all these things... It isn't something, you can't force it, you can't impose it, you can't kind of go, oh, I should feel devotion or you should feel devotion, just as you can't say, you know, I should feel gratitude or you should feel gratitude, just as you can't make yourself feel metta, so it can't be forced. But at the same time, it can be cultivated, yeah, so it can't be forced, but it can be cultivated. But then that immediately begs another question, is like, well, why cultivate it? Why am I even why am I even bothering with this section on devotion and the true individual? And actually, it's not even just that I'm bothering with it. I'm, in my mind, this is the most important one of all. But why? Why? So I'll try and say a little bit about why I think why. So I think the main thing to realise in cultivating devotion is that we cultivate it, I cultivate it, we cultivate it, like for, well, this isn't the end of the story, this is the beginning, like for ourselves. So, like, the Buddha doesn't actually need us to be devoted. You know, when we, you know, when you say entreaty and supplication verse of the puja, it's not actually that the Buddhas are waiting for us to say that, to give their blessings. Not literally, although it's not that either. I'll come back to that. And it's not actually that Bhante needed us to be devoted to him. It's more the other way around, that I certainly think this, that I need the devotion. I need somebody to be devoted to. Again, I got a little glimpse of this with Bhante many, many years ago. Bhante used to live at the London Buddhist Centre, and this was in the days when he was healthy and well, and used to be out and about. Anyway, he was going off for some long trip, I think to Australia or New Zealand. And Maitreya Bandhu had this idea. I think he was leaving really early in the morning, going away for a long time. Maitreya Bandhu, who's one of the order members there, had this idea, well, let's all get up early and wave goodbye to Bhante. So a bunch of us got up, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning, and stood there, and as Bhante was driven off to the airport, waved to him. And Bhante really smiled. He really, really smiled. And I remember, I think it was long before I was me, but me probably wasn't even a mitra at the time. But I remember just having this intuition of, like, he's happy for us. Do you know what I mean? It's not so much that, I'm sure he was glad and it was nice to be with, but I thought, oh, he's happy for us. Yes, something about, again, it's quite hard to put this into words, but it will do something Something will happen to us if we can cultivate devotion. Another more recent example, a friend of mine who I live with in the community, Holly, she's, you know, feels this strong connection with Bhante and had hoped to meet him, but then he got ill and everything. And then she happened to be on retreat at Adristana this winter when Bhante got very ill and got rushed off to hospital in the night with pneumonia. And, you know, this really affected her, and his picture was on the shrine as it is now. And she said that she just started to, you know, being affected by, you know, the thoughts of him being off in hospital, she just started that every time she went to the shrine, she touched her head in front of the photograph on the shrine. And she said an amazing thing happened. She said as she did that, like, the whole Dharma took on a new meaning. She said the Dharma became illuminated in a new way. She hadn't expected that. And in a way, how could you expect it? But the Dharma itself became just more... I asked her again about it today, knowing I was coming here. She just said it was like it was all fresh and new. So that's... I'm trying to sort of illustrate that that's why I'm talking about devotion as an important thing. It's kind of for us. I'm trying to say that the Buddha or Bhante doesn't need our devotion. That they're not, it's not that they're going to withhold their teaching unless we're devoted to them. And yes, that is true, but I think there's something... It's only kind of true. And again, I was trying to think of a little example. So here's a little example from my own life. So I'm teaching this back in London. I'm teaching this study seminar. And it was a bit weird saying the same thing. I hope I don't say anything negative about anybody on tape. But anyway, I'm teaching this study seminar with a whole bunch of mitras, and some of them have had to pull out of the seminar, so some of them have written to me saying, sorry, I actually can't manage to come anymore. Now, some of them have, in that letter of resigning from the group, have expressed a lot of gratitude. I've said, oh, really thanks to you and the other order members for doing this, but I'm really sorry I can't come anymore. Others haven't been quite so expressive of that, you know. And what I noticed was, in a sense, I don't really mind. I don't really mind. I'm doing the group, you know. I don't really mind how many people come or don't come. In a certain sense, I don't mind who says they're grateful and who doesn't. At the same time, the people who did express their gratitude, it's like I feel more of an affinity with them. But it's kind of, it's because I'm glad for them. I hope I can put this into words. It's like gratitude has it got an affinity with the growth, I think. And because I can think, it's hard to quite put it. It's too subtle. The words almost seem to accrue. But you see what I mean? It's a sort of affinity. I say, I can see you're growing because you can express gratitude. And because you're trying to grow and I'm trying to grow, there's an affinity, and it's not that, you know, I don't like the other people who didn't and that I blame them or even in a certain sense mind. And it's, but at the same time, there is something that connects one when somebody expresses gratitude. And then I was thinking, it's a bit like even in ordinary communication, we communicate to people who are listening. It's very hard to communicate to someone who isn't listening. I remember once I was giving a talk and I looked down in the audience and someone was, I don't know why they were doing this, they might have had a perfectly good reason, but they were kind of doing something like this. It's quite hard to kind of, it's quite hard to carry on. And in more subtle ways, you know, that if, I don't know, say you've been on retreat and somebody says, how was your retreat? It's like some people you want to tell and you can tell because you feel they really are listening, and some people, it's kind of strangely more difficult to tell because you're not quite totally convinced they really want to know, you know. So anyway, I think this is all in the arena of the gratitude, from the disciples' point of view, is important. It's not that the Buddha or Bhante or whoever literally needs it. At the same time, it will build more connection. I was talking to Dharma Dina this morning at breakfast, who I also live with, and she came up with, she remembered, I think it's a Tibetan little saying, which I asked her to write down. So she said, this is it: if you behold them with faithful eyes, you will be blessed by a rain of grace. Yeah. So if you behold your teacher with faithful eyes, you'll be blessed by a rain of grace. So it's like that. You'll kind of open the channel for Adishtana. So you will benefit. And of course, I've been saying the gratitude devotion is important for us, but what I want to emphasize is it's not just for us. It's like, to the extent we can feel gratitude and devotion and open that channel of Adishtana, then we are participating in, it's like a lineage of inspiration. Well, Bhante's called it that, a lineage of inspiration that then can keep flowing. To the extent we don't, we will block the lineage of inspiration and it won't keep flowing. So when I say it's for us, I mean it's for us as part of the chain, the handing on of the flame, whichever metaphor one wants to use. So I'm just drawing to a close of what I want to say now. So what I'm arguing is, well, I keep using this word argument, but anyway, that if you want to be a friend, if you want to help people, if you want to keep the lineage of inspiration alive, then you need to practice to become more and more of a true individual. And if you, and it'll work the other way around as well, and also if you are a true individual, that's all you want to do. Ah, that's the bit I get most excited by. That's all you want to do. So a true individual, that's all they'll care about. If you are a true individual, you'll just want to be a friend. You won't even want to be. It'll just be your second nature to be a friend. If you are a true individual, it'll be second nature to help people. It won't even, you know, it won't even be a thought or a question. It'll be second nature to help people. You'll be just looking for opportunities to do that. And if you are an individual, you want to keep that lineage of inspiration alive and flowing. Like, what else could you do? It'll be the, that's what it'll be like. It'll be like, what else could I do? What else would my life be for? And thinking of the Buddha, I was thinking, well, you know, you can see this in the life story of the Buddha. So I think it's quite interesting to think of the Buddha as a friend, isn't it? We're very, very easy to think of the Buddha as helping people. I've got loads of stories about that, you know, from Kisagoto and Gunamala, all the people the Buddha helped. I was thinking of the Buddha as a friend, and I was thinking about what's very interesting, how as soon as the Buddha's enlightened, actually he goes back to his friends, you know, even though they've left him, the ascetics. Well, first of all, he thinks of his two teachers, doesn't he? But they've died, he goes back to the ascetics. And I think he goes to them because they're his friends, you know. So the Buddha as a friend. And then we've got the Buddha as a disciple. So the Buddha in the Garbha Sutta, as we know, looks, wants to revere someone. So it's very, very interesting. He doesn't find someone, of course, because he's the Buddha, but he's looking for someone first and foremost, so to honour, to revere, and to worship. So you've got that discipleship principle in the Buddha. Of course, he reveres and relies upon the Dharma because he doesn't find someone, but he's looking for someone. That's who he looks for. So you've got the discipleship principle. So it's always in relationship. So this whole teaching, the true individual given to us by Bhante, it's always in relationship. Maybe it isn't a paradox in the end. It seems like a paradox, but in the end, by definition, it's always in relationship, because that's all a true individual will want to do, those three things: be a friend, help people, and keep the lineage of inspiration alive. So always in relationship, which of course accords with the way things are, which is relationship, which is pratichasamutpada, which is, that's reality. That's what reality is. So I think I'm going to stop over there. How's the time? It's 2 minutes past nine.
Two minutes past nine.
Have we got time for questions?
Well, let's just go straight. Is everybody fine?
Sure. Is there any question on what I've said?
Questions?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, if anybody's got any questions or, as I say, clarifications or things you don't agree with, or things you want to switch around, maybe we'll do it for a little while and then should we end with a mantra or something? Yeah, we could end with a mantra about, what, 20 fast, a mantra?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, so that gives us...
I'm not sure I've got a question. Thank you so much. I mean, that's not only very clear... three things kind of but really beautifully kind of flowing into each other. And then I'm just kind of left with that sense of like, well, how do I be a good friend without me being in it? That's another talk, I'm sure.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because maybe it does come back to the, well, if we're not enlightened, then there will be me in it. So it's definitely not waiting. We can't wait till we're enlightened. We can't wait till we're a Buddha to be a friend. It's actually, that's where we can do things as a practice. So by trying to be a friend, we'll become more of a true individual. And by practicing to be more of a true individual, we'll become more of a friend. So it's like in the doing of it, you know, the phrase is often used as that purifies it, but maybe it's things that we get to see it by, like, say, by me, like, trying to help my sister and then her sister. It sort of throws that up and then you see it. So you won't get to see it without the doing of it. So it's like actually doing it, see what gets thrown up, and maybe looking at that as unflinchingly as we can. It's just like, oh, you know. And I think that's what we mean by saying, if we just keep practicing, it will sort of come out in the wash, as it were. But kind of having those things in mind, I think the important thing is to realise that we won't be able to, without working on ourselves and without working on our own tendencies to want approval and so on, we won't be able to be a friend. Yeah, but actually, it works both ways. By really, sometimes we care so much about something, we can have that positive self-forgetting, and then there can be moments of individuality, which I'm sure you, everybody's felt, you know, experienced. Yeah, where we really have been selfless, we've just wanted another person's happiness. So we've wanted to,
Because it reminds me, I want to be in my friendships. So how can I be a friend without being in it? It's like, oh, I don't want that actually. I want to be in my friendships. Mm. So it's sort of like, it's just the language we use, I think, sometimes, isn't it? It's like, it's friendship. It's not, so we can talk about being a friend.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Then I was sort of getting lost in that, thinking, wait a second, where am I in this? It's like, oh, it's a friendship. Which is a relational thing between two people, which has two individuals.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's not like, I suppose there's a near enemy there that you could.
Oh yeah,
not
you could just get detached. Exactly. For fear of that. Yeah.
Yeah, or trying to take yourself out of the equation. But actually, I want to be part of it.
Okay, so maybe I'll clarify. So when I said there's too much me in it, there's maybe better. Maybe that was shorthand for me saying, there's too much wanting approval, wanting praise, wanting something reciprocated. So I think, yes, that is, we will want that as unenlightened human beings if we're not enlightened. But to the extent we do, then selfish, I suppose. I was trying to think of a kind of kinder way to put it, but and to the extent we're selfish, we're limited in our friendship. It's not that we're not a friend at all. The more selfish we are, the more limited we are. Mm-hmm.
You know what you said about Bunty and sent him off on his long trip.
Yeah.
And it explains something I've been thinking about, he's famous for the fact that you can never embarrass him by thanking him. And a lot of us, we go, thank you, say, all right, leave it, that's enough. But that explains it, that he's actually looking at the people. It's not just, he's got some amazing ability to absorb gratitude and stuff. That's interesting,
So is what you mean something like, there's a sort of maturity and just being able to receive people's gratitude? Is that what you meant, Isabella? No.
He can receive it, but what helps is also he's seeing it's good for them.
Yes.
Grateful.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Aware of them.
Yeah, oh, I see.
That was the point of what you said, wasn't it? And you thought, it's not just that. What's going on in there?
That's what I meant.
Like he's delighting in people's positive mental states.
That's it. Delighting in people's positive mental state.
Gratitude is challenging as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because from the point of view of the individualist, he is often afraid of expressing gratitude because it means they're beholden to somebody else.
That's what it can feel like, can't it? A bit like forgiveness and apology as well, same sort of thing, isn't it?
I thought it was interesting the way you teased out, and I have to listen to this again, I think, because the whole complex of responsibility really does sort of like, for me, operate the relationship between the individual and the community, responding, being able to respond. And that is like negative as much as positive. So negative in terms of apology is taking responsibility for realizing I've done something not so ethical here and letting another person, communicating that to another person. Yeah. And then the positive responsibility of what you said about teaching meditation.
Yeah.
Do you see a connection there, like the ability to be responsible for a negative influence and the responsibility for the positive influence?
Yeah, it's both, isn't it? Yeah, that's good. Yeah, thank you. What about this whole area of devotion? What about this whole thing? What does it feel like when I just, even describing someone going and, you know, touching their head to a photo of Bhante on the shrine?
I don't know if this connects with the thought I was having in your last section. But I was turning it round and thinking, how do we respond to somebody else who is a true individual or contains some of the many of the qualities of the true individual, because I think it requires us to allow them not to fit our shape that we'd rather they filled, like a gingerbread my teacher or whatever. But letting them be who they are.
That's a really good point, isn't it? And that sort of almost makes, just when you said it, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because if by definition, if they are more, whatever word, words are so clumsy, aren't they, evolved or developed than us, we can only think about them in our terms, and that is going to be limited, because by definition, we are, not that we're, we're less than them, but we've only got our terms to think about it in. We've got to allow for there might be something more than we know, but at the same time, without falling into the extreme of being gullible, it's interesting to navigate, isn't
it? It's really tricky, and I think we grow through the discomfort of finding ourselves in that situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Ramotra. There's not an easy answer. You know, all the time we've been, all our intelligence has been, you know, we have to have it active. We have to have it, our sort of, I was going to say our wits about us, but it's more than just our wits.
Living with the uncomfortable feelings.
Can
I ask, do you think that there's something similar that happens there with guilt? I was very interested in what you were saying about guilt. That maybe as you develop as an individual, your guilt looks different or becomes something different or lessens or So it's not a kind of concrete thing that you have to deal with, but that somehow as you develop it, it shifts.
I think that's almost certainly true. That, well, because guilt, so I'm definitely distinguishing guilt from positive, like, shame, you know, skillful shame. So because guilt, by definition, is based on, well, just this need for approval, then as you become more individual, it'll definitely lessen.
Yeah.
And but actually, interesting, if you're free, your positive shame may increase because you'll be more ethically sensitive.
Yeah.
So that, it's a funny thing, free, because it's painful positive, and actually it'll both lessen and increase as you go along. Because it'll lessen because presumably you're doing less unskillful things.
Yeah.
But it'll increase because the slightest unskillfulness will just feel like, well, more unbearable, you know, more that you have to confess it.
Yeah.
So smaller and smaller things will, there'll be that pressure to confess and apologise. So it's a strange thing that it both decreases and increases at the same time. Yeah. So as guilt decreases, free may well increase. Mm. But also, as we become more of an individual, we'll be able to distinguish between the two, which is crucial, actually, to think, when am I actually feeling genuine free and when am I just feeling guilt?
Yeah.
And sometimes I find it helpful to ask myself, well, you know, I just ask myself the question, have I done anything unskillful? Have I broken a precept? And who do I think's going to, like, blame me? Who do I think's going to disapprove? Because often when I feel guilt, it's in relation to someone in my mind. Like, I think, oh, so-and-so's going to be cross with me if they find out. So-and-so's going to disapprove. Funny, the path of responsibility, because that can play into it as well. You know, I get, you know, oh my god, like, now I'm a public preceptor, or like, they'll never allow me to be a public preceptor now, or, you know, so whatever we can use. And then I know, oh, that's guilt. If I'm thinking that, that's guilt, you know. If I'm thinking I'll be sort of judged in that way, it's very different from free and apatrapia, you know. It's probably time for one last question.
Just remembering that you were saying about that woman who touched her head on the shrine, that, and just remembering when Vajrapriya left here, who was my Mitra convener. Mitra study leader and Mitra Kavina, and also working with him in the team, sort of giving him the send off. It didn't seem, it just felt like it was just saying goodbye to a work colleague or something. But when he actually got to it, it was very, you know, if someone had said beforehand I'd be doing that, touching my head before him or something, it would have sounded silly. But just the way, I think it was the way he got all this sort of blessings and stuff, and he didn't seem like he seemed really happy, but he, like you're saying, he didn't seem to take it on personally. And it just, it just got this sense of it, sort of a bigger thing, really. And I said this session, it was like he wasn't, we weren't really, we were sort of rejoicing in him, but he was really rejoicing in Sangha. And it didn't feel like there was a didn't feel like us two separate, didn't feel like us and him, it just felt like one thing. I think he felt that as well. I think that's that seems to be under a lot of what you were saying, in a way, you're sort of struggling with the almost self and other clumsiness of it, but in action, if it works, it becomes this one.
All of
this stuff becomes this one thing. And that I wasn't, that surprised me, experiencing that. As you say, most of the time I don't, most of the time, I'm stuck. I mean, it's got a clumsy, where am I, where's the other person?
That's beautiful. That's really beautifully put, actually. It's a beautiful experience, beautifully put. Thank you.
And a lovely place to...
Yeah.
So can we thank you one more time?